In the next selection, Richard discusses the difference between the useful methods NLP has developed and the attitudes that made these discoveries possible. One is the attitude that anything can be accomplished. It's just a matter of finding out how. Another is the value of our taking an active stance towards living rather than being only a passive responder to events.
NLP is not just a methodology, it's also an attitude. And see, for example, one of the major parts that, you know, some of you may not have changed in your belief system, which you might get around to, is that you really have to have the belief that you can do, that anything is something that can be done. Because you see, if there is anything that you can't do, you don't have to worry about it, because you just won't be able to do it. So if you have the attitude that you're going to be able to do anything, it's only a question of when. See, failure itself is defined by time limits. And one of the things that will account, especially if you see private clients, that one of the things that you will hear for them is that when you begin to hear the word try in sentences, it usually will be justifying having the limitations that they do. They'll say things like, well, you know, I quit smoking, you know, and then 3 weeks later I started again. Now, they usually use that as a description that the process that they used didn't work, rather than it occurring to them that they didn't continue to use it. You know, when people describe to you that they have voices, and for example, have you done belief changes with people, and when you tell them to move a picture, they tell you they can't? Right? You know, they go to move it, and they go, it won't move. That's different than the person who says, I am unable to move it. Those are two totally different utterances, and it tells you something about what it is that you have to accomplish. Because when people are passive in relationship to their own mind, then the first thing you have to do is you have to begin to get them to be active. Now, for those of you who, for example, saw the tape of me working with Andy, the little paranoid schizophrenic, one of the things about Andy is that these figures in his mind that were torturing him, that little figures that came off the TV set and ragged on him and nagged him and stuff, was that they, when he described them, they weren't his. He didn't have ownership. But when people describe their mental process in a disassociated form, now when people begin to describe, whether it's in business consulting or whatever, that they don't have the ability to control some part of themselves, you can hear the difference in them when they begin to describe, because they always claim it's their problem. They'll come in and they'll go, well, I have this terrible problem. And you go, what is it? And they'll say, well, you know, I start drinking and I can't stop myself. You know, immediately you begin to hear the disassociation at that point, as soon as they can't stop themselves. But then when you start to question them and ask what happens internally, they say, well, you know, I tell myself I should, but I don't. Now, when people say things, and you'll hear it in phrases like when people say to you, I can't, all of the things that which are limits, I can't, you know I should, but it's just that, you know, this voice keeps nagging me, that I can't stop it. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the point where your ear has to tune in to find out what's in control and what's out of control. This little thing that I wrote up here is a thing from a field called decision theory. Now, the people who actually created the field of decision theory just actually broke it down into simple things. The thing is that in the environment there are certain fixed variables, like there are a certain number of hours of the day. Now, there are also a certain set of variables which are social variables. For example, most of us in here, not all of us, but most of us in here are native speakers of English. If not, we're a native speaker of some language. But being a native speaker of English, it puts a certain grid over your thinking process. If you were a native speaker of German, for example, there aren't modal operators of possibility in German. They simply can't say, you know, hey, what would you like to do today? You know, it's what must you do today? they just don't have them in the language. They actually sent somebody from Germany to ask advice about how to translate one of my books, because the thing about modal operators of possibility drove them nuts. You know, they couldn't actually have to in order, because they told them they had to do it that way. Of course, they could understand that. Now, there's also a set of personal variables. Personal variables are the things that you learn as an individual, given that you're a native speaker of English. Some people grew up in the streets of New Jersey, and some people, you know, grew up in Upper Long Island, and some people in the Deep South. And above and beyond that, even given the family that you grew up, you learn different things like values and beliefs and just straight ahead skills. Now, if you take all of these things, it's the job of the decision theorist to take an individual. Because when you take individuals and you have them make a list, or if you just listen to them, things that are supposed to be over here somehow or other end up on this list of environmental constraints. For Andy, part of the environment was his internal dialogue and his internal images. They weren't a personal thing. As far as he was concerned, and the way he was living his life, they were part of the environment. That the internal voices or the internal pictures wasn't something that was personally his. It was part of the environment. Now, very often, people make their beliefs part of the environment. That's why people like, when I started doing belief change work with people, you know, because people were always asking me about it, and I keep telling them, it's not that hard. So finally, I put the thing in using your brain for change. If you change beliefs, you just find out what they are, find out what they're not, and you change them. And when I do it in seminars, people would say, you mean you could just change a belief just like that? Now, the fact that they were so amazed is because they had that as a part of the environment. It's not that you have a belief, it's that you believe something, and it's an ongoing process that you have to continue to do. And since it doesn't feel like an active process, people go, well, it's not one. But if you ask people things like, what would happen if you could just change your beliefs? Well, they go, well, if you could just change your beliefs like that, then you wouldn't know what to believe. And you'd go completely nuts. Now, that's going to be one of the worst pieces of logic I have ever heard. But, I mean, that is like about one of the worst justifications I've ever heard for not changing one belief. I mean, but it sounds meaningful enough that I know that therapists have probably bought it. It's like they go, yeah, you wouldn't know what to believe. You're right. You know? Now, it actually falls out. If you study predicate calculus, which is the study of a valid but untrue logic, it actually is a logical fallacy. It's an invalid and untrue argument. But if your intonation sounds good, you can slide that right through. That's what Robert calls sleight of mouth. Now, the thing is that if you really stop and think about it, if you can change your beliefs, then you're going to pick ones that are worth having and keep them, as opposed to let them randomly occur.
In the 15 years since the beginning of NLP, it has developed into a vast and wide-ranging field. Submodalities, an important and powerful means of producing change, is but one of the avenues open with NLP. There is also anchoring, which allows us to have resourceful feelings when we want them, reframing, which opens up new possibilities of behavior and feelings, and strategies, how to gain automatic thought sequences that support what we want to do in life, language patterns, and much more. In the next selection, a woman asks Richard for help with her reading. Richard responds that it's really about how she limits her understanding and answers her and us with a metaphoric solution.
I have a problem with reading. And
what problem?
Well, I can read a fantasy novel because it makes pictures in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But all of this goes with the fact that I'd like to get a degree, but I can't do the academic thing because if I read a book, I fall asleep or something like that.
When you read nonfiction, don't you make pictures in your head when you do that? Like if you read chemistry, don't you make pictures of the molecules? You know, Einstein always had himself riding on light beams. I mean, what do you do?
I get tired, and the words start jumping off the page and stuff, and they don't stay where they belong.
Right. What do you mean the words jump off the page?
They don't stay in line.
Do you get through more than one page?
Sometimes, if I'm really successful,
yeah,
I can read about a page and a half.
That's it.
And lately, I've actually had a few experiences with books that are halfway academic and halfway pictures, where I can actually read half a chapter at a time.
Well, that's pretty good. Sounds like you're getting a handle on it.
But that's only books that make pictures, sort of.
What kind of books don't make pictures?
I don't know, the ones that aren't about fantasies.
Well, I mean, there isn't anything in school they teach you about that is not someone's fantasy. So what part of school is not fantasy? I mean, you know, this is what I want to know. I mean, I went to college, you know.
Well, maybe that's my problem. Maybe if I knew it wasn't, if I thought it wasn't fantasy, I would take it seriously and be able to do it.
Well, I mean, when these guys write about, I mean, have you ever listened to stuff these guys write about in college? I mean, you know, they're telling you, think about a double helix molecule. I mean, what do they tell you? They go, in order to comprehend, you know, the infinite complexities of the helix matrix molecule.
Did that make pictures in your mind?
Well, I'm waiting for them to tell me what the picture is.
That's my problem. They don't tell me.
Yeah, they do. They go as far as to tell you, you see a mirror and imagine a helix. Well, see, the helix molecule, first thing you have to do is look at the picture of it in the book. So you know what one looks like. Right. See, for example, a lot of people have trouble with math because they always give you this bunch of gibberish, and then they give you an equation that says the same thing. People look at the equations and they feel inferior. They don't realize the equation and the words say the same thing. I mean, it's like, you know, goes if man x were blah 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 blah, and then they give you this little formula. People look at the formulas, feel bad. They don't realize that's because when they went to elementary school, they used to look at those things and feel bad. It's straight ahead anchoring. Pavlovian conditioning. You have to re-anchor yourself so that when... See, if you looked at every book, for example, I want you to stop. Pick one of the what you consider to be non-fiction books that you have tried to read. One where the words...
I have a whole bookshelf in front of my mind.
I said pick one, will you?
Okay.
Okay, you have to just pick one that you've opened. Now, what is it?
It's Tortora's Anatomy and Physiology.
That's nothing but pictures. What are you talking about?
No, there's little tiny writing all on the page.
Yeah, but it's all descriptions of pictures, isn't it?
Yeah, but the descriptions make no sense.
Well, did you notice there's pictures in the book too?
Oh, I don't like the pictures. They don't make sense to me either.
Why not? Because you didn't read the words that go with them?
No, I just, like I said, I get tired. I look, nothing relates. I mean, I've gotten around that one because I touch bodies and I know where things go, but...
Yeah.
I still can't read an anatomy book.
Okay, well now, if you think of the anatomy book instead as an adventure through somebody's mind, because, you see, when you think about anatomy, you think about it one way. But here was this guy, he's not even alive anymore, right, who is sitting in some foreign country.
I'd rather look at his cadaver.
Yeah, I know you would, but you think about this guy looking at cadavers, you know, in some basement in London. Right? And he's looking at the cadavers, and as he's looking at the bodies, trying to figure out each little thing, this is the way his mind perceives the body. And see, did you ever see that show where they put and shrunk the people down and had them go through the human?
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever see that? Every time you read anything about body work, the most important thing to understand is the fantasy trip is to get inside the other guy's mind. It's not that you're supposed to understand your way. You're supposed to understand his way. And I mean, it may be much more complex than the way you do, but you have to, as you read the words, you literally are on like an amusement park ride. That if you literally take the words and instead of try to understand them, literally flow along with them. And whenever they stop with a picture, right, you go to that picture. Just take it as a ride. So what you're riding through is somebody else's understanding of the world. See, when people ask me questions a lot in seminars, a lot of times I know something that they don't know. They will always say that what they're trying to do is to understand. And that's not really what they're doing. They're trying to get me to say something that will fit the way they understand. See, if I change it just the right way, they'll go, oh, yeah. But they don't understand because they have not changed their perceptions to match mine. When I read a book, for example, when I read Einstein for the first time, the thing is that for me, that was one of the greatest adventure books I ever read. because I did everything he said in the book. And I mean, what an author is going to do is he says, now, if you stop and you look at this particular thing in anatomy, and he gives it a nice big name. Well, if I don't know what the name means, the first thing I have to do is stop and find out what is it, and then I have to have a picture of it. Now, if this guy was writing the book from having a cadaver, you have to build in your mind a fantasy cadaver. You know, even if it takes another anatomy book that has a picture. But you literally, I mean, to me, with an anatomy book, I literally take my massage table and set it up. And I sit down and open the anatomy book. It's the same way I do with a science fiction book, so that I can follow what this guy is talking about. Because, surprisingly enough, for this guy, doing this was an adventure where he would not have been able to write it down. Now, if you try to make it match your world, it's not going to seem like an adventure, because you're not going to get to feel like you're a stuffy old guy in an English cellar, some Oxford scholar. If you try to read it out of the... if you read a science fiction novel and the hero was that kind of a character, you'd get into it. If he got usurped into some planet in outer space and had to use his mind and his intellect to cope with whatever strange things, you get into it. It's just that, you know, you're going, it doesn't fit my world. Well, I want to tell you, that world is as far from science fantasy as it's going to other planets. Boy, getting inside of this shoes, you know, these guys sitting around in basements slicing up bodies, you know, and being intrigued with watching the way a little muscle moves, or a little something, you can read it that way. Your mind can look at it that way. Have you got a book here? No. Maybe at lunch, go out and find something that you would consider hard to read. The thing is that if you always stop and ask yourself, what story am I reading? You can go on an adventure, you can read anything. Because every book is written by a person who is going on some kind of an adventure. And anybody who writes an 800 or 900 page book on anatomy had to be into it. They had to be into it in the deep trance and the most fantasy sense of the word. Believe me, all of those things can be, you can treat it, your mind can look at it. But, you know, if when you read a piece of science fiction, you have a person to identify with. When you read a piece of nonfiction, you identify with the person that's writing it. Don't feel like he's talking to you. Feel like you're saying it.
Very often, when someone isn't getting where they want in their life, it's simply because they hesitate to do something. Richard teaches his three-step mental program for getting from hesitation to consider it done. This is a somewhat longer and more complex process than we present on the rest of this tape. We present it to give a taste of the depth and systematic nature of Richard's training, and a glimpse of the rich rewards available to those who really want to use their brains to improve their lives.
Because I've discovered one of the things that's a useful response in human beings can be in patience. That there's a whole lot of waiting going on in human beings, and that the waiting itself, it's, I don't know why they're waiting for, but it's a natural response, and I think that that we're trained very, very young to wait for things, you know, to wait for meals, to wait for other people, to wait in line. And especially when you're children, you spend a lot of your time waiting for adults. You know, I mean, you know, they tell you to get ready to go somewhere, and you get your coat on, and you're all ready, and then they sit and talk to somebody. And of course, when you're a kid, you know, you've only been alive for a short period of time. You remember when you were children, you know, that a month seemed like forever, and now they go by whoosh, like this? Well, I mean, when you were 5 years old, and you had to wait 10 minutes for your mother, you know, to put on that last dash of makeup, you know, that seemed like an eternity. And you were taught that you had to wait and wait and wait. And as you get older, that those waiting programs operate automatically. Stop for a minute and think of something that you know you've already done and can do. Okay? Now, think of something that you would really like to do, you know, and when you think about trying it, your heart beats and all that sort of stuff. You know, I've always, see, to me, like a lot of people have talked about what they think the major problems people are. One of the major problems that I think people have is that they hesitate. You know, my adage is, you know, those who hesitate, wait. And, you know, that it's one thing, you know, to jump in blindly, you know, and fall in a ditch. But it's another thing, you know, to not walk up and look to see if there is a ditch. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that I find that, you know, that if people knew that people will always want to go second, or they want to do things the second time, it's like, well, you know, if I knew that this person felt that way, then I would have done this. Instead of, you know, using the thing is a lot of people try to gain external information about how to interact with others. They try to gain that information internally. And now, I'm serious, they really do, you know, that it's like they go inside to find out what someone else is thinking. And see, I have a surprise for you. It's not there. There's a thing called just asking. There's people go, but what if I was rejected? Well, see, what you do is you can build a strategy that there are many of us that have, is that we look at life as a smorgasbord, and that it's a gourmet smorgasbord at that. And that the thing is that when you try something and you don't like what you get, you try something else. Now, the thing is if your strategies have to do with building up the enthusiasm and the wantonness of really being able to go for it, one of the things that allows a lot of people to be able to do things is that they're not really doing them for the first time. Because when they think about like just even, you know, walking across the room and asking somebody to dance, a total stranger, right? For some people, that's like a fearful situation. Now, these are not people who spent a lot of time in combat, usually. But they're people that for them, that's like being on the edge, you know? Now, I wish life was like that for the rest of us sometimes. The phenomenon of stopping and thinking about something that's in the past is that you can take new things that you want to do, and it means that you can do them a second time. Now, there's also another element that I want you to be able to add to this, is there's the element of, have you ever known that something was just inevitably going to happen?
Yes.
Wouldn't it be nice if when you wanted something, you were in that state? Right? I mean, it's like, you know, there are certain things that for most people, a lot of the things about something being inevitable is it's usually unpleasant, you know. I know he's going to find out. It's going to be inevitable. He's going to come in. He's going to yell at me, right? And it is inevitable, right? And, you know, to the point we're almost relieved when it gets there. It is inevitable that I'm going to develop something new because I couldn't keep doing the same thing over and over again. It'd drive me crazy. Anyway, it's just a function of being able to listen and observe to what people tell me. So that when you stop and you think about something, see, for me, it's like if I stop and I go in and I find something that's past tense, okay, what I make that's past tense is that it is inevitable that I will do new things. Now, I know it sounds like a little bit of a dichotomy, but what we're talking about here is something called chaining. When you take an idea about something being easy and you being good at something, and you make it first past tense, and then you make it inevitable, it gets it from the past to the future. But it makes it seem old. But not old in the sense of being tired, old in the sense that it is inevitably going to go your way. Now, if you add to that the element of not only is it inevitable, but you approach it with wanton expectation, then what happens is you develop something inside your attitude that allows you to snarl internally. You know, it's like, the thing is that a lot of people get frustrated. And like, you know, when I ask somebody a question, you know, and they give me this, well, I can't move the picture. This is a good one I got today. I can't move the picture because it's panoramic. Right. Right. Oh, excuse me. You know, now you can't move a panoramic picture Well, I'm sorry, you'll have to stay the way you are. When I hear that word can't, I think about it as if this person already has. Right? I start there. In other words, I know it's done. And, I mean, a lot of times you've probably said to somebody, you know, well, I need to have, you know, so-and-so things from the store. And they say to you, consider it done. Now, I found out that the people that are like that are good people to have working for you because it is done. The thing is they do it in their mind. It's done. Now, the thing is they don't just do it in their mind. Because I have had many people who work for me that were just like that. And I don't need any more of those. Yep, it's done. Now, what else do you want me to do? No. This is not what we're after. The thing about it being done is they put it in past tense that they're going to do it. Not that it is completed. What I want you to do is to be able to build a chain using submodalities. And this is a little different. The thing is that when you use submodalities to do chaining, you spend a little bit more time doing elicitation, but your installation goes so much more smoothly that way. That when something is past tense, when it's oops, it's done. It's like the thing that Robert's post-hypnotic suggestion strategy in order to find his car again. Okay, he goes to the airport, right? He gets out of his car. He turns around and he looks at where his car is, and then he sees what he would see if he was walking out and getting back in his car. So he goes, yep, I can find it. Now, if somebody would say to him coming out of the airport and they were walking along, they'd say, do you know where your car is? And he'd go, yeah, I know where it is. Consider it done. I'm there. Right? And, you know, somebody will look up and go, you're there. But the thing is he can go from where he is in his mind all the way through the process to where his car is. Now, that's what this element is of being able to run through and have the activity done. In other words, it's one thing, you know, to see yourself walking across the room with quaking knees, terror in your voice, hear a quaky voice, and say to a lady, would you like to dance with me? You know. Now, I don't consider this considering it done. This is considering it not done. Right? Okay. Because you don't see yourself wanting to do it. Now, if you go through the submodalities of some event where you see it and it's done, it's matter of fact. Okay. You switch from this to, what was the second one? Inevitable. Right? All right. That it is inevitable. It is inevitable when you get on a plane that you're going to have to find your car when you get out. But there are certain things in life which are inevitable. Okay. The inevitability, you know, it's like the good kind of inevitable is when there's somebody that you see and you know it is inevitable that you're going to talk to them and you want to. My policy is, why wait? Only until you feel the timing is right. So, there's no need to wait for that either. Right. The time is now. In order to build a chain, right? See, I always throw in inevitable is the same as want and desire. It means that you want it so bad, right? Then the only thing you need to add. Now, what I want you to do is to be able to go through and to elicit what it is that makes something so much so that it's done. Consider it done, right? Now, this is also something that hasn't already occurred. It's something that hasn't happened yet. But it's just that when somebody says it, it's going to go down that way. Now, this is where when people do it in this submodality, this is where they keep their word. And, you know, there are some people that are missing parts of this, but not all the time. Sometimes it's, you know, it's just going and getting something from the kitchen. Find an exquisite example of that, and what I want you to do is to elicit the things that make that unique. Okay, this is not where we're looking for similarities. This time, what we want to know is how to start with, and what we'll pick on here is the first piece is we will start with hesitation.
Okay. We will go to from hesitation to done. Now, you're going to find a wide disparity here. Now, normally when you do chaining, you look for more gradual steps. But in this case, what we're going to do is take something that somebody, and have people pick something that they need to do in their life, that they find themselves hesitating, you know, like getting a job, you know, or whatever it happens to be. This is what I found out is the perfect thing to give to your relatives when they ask you, well, what is NLP? This is the one that I use. This one right here. You know, having many friends and relatives who managed to stay unemployed and in my home. Right. When they go, well, what are you doing workshops? I go, sit down, I'll show you. And then it is inevitable that the time is now that they're gone. Now, what I want you to look for this time is the differences. Because whereas before we were trying to build something, the thing that we're going to do this time is I also want you to anchor each state. Because what we're looking for here is a rapid set of shifts. Now, what I want you to do when you find out that something is done, go back to the hesitation, to the something where somebody goes, consider it done. Now, there may be a whole bunch of differences. I want you to see if you can eliminate any of those differences and have it not matter. In other words, take the thing that's done. You know, they go, all right, there's something that somebody would hesitate to do. Something, if you ask them to do it, they go, consider it done. This time, the way you're going to do your elicitation is, as you go through and you find out a difference, right? They go, well, when I think about this, I know, consider it done, right? And this one's here, right? This one's over here. This time, what you're going to do is take the thing that's done and move over here and find out, is it still done? If it's not, then you move it back. Right? Because it may not have to do with the size. There may be a difference in the size of the image, but it may not make any difference. Even though if you take the done one and you make it the same size as hesitation, as long as it's over here, it's done. Now, this is the way you search and find what are critical submodalities. So that rather than having to go through and change 7 or 8 things, all you're going to have to do is make sure you change that one, and you're going to get most of it. The rest, by the way, usually will come automatically. This is a particular sorting principle to allow you to start to streamline what you need to change now. Instead of changing everything and being rigorous, this is where you go for the big pieces. Now, what you want to find out is the big piece that's the difference between hesitation and done. Done to inevitable. You find an example of where something is inevitable. They know it's going to happen and they want it. Okay. And an example of something where people just go for it. That time is now. They're not going to wait. Now, there are certain things in life where you have that experience. For some people, it's just when the plate goes in front of them at dinner. But wherever it is, find it. You know, examples of where it's not a question of they're going to get it done. It's just they jump into behavior. It's a thing where they click. From planning to doing. It may be, you know, when you close the door in your office and turn around and look at your client and start to drool out of the corner of your mouth. Come to me, will you, and try and stay the same. Now, once you have these pieces, what I want you to do is to go back to the thing that the content of what they hesitate about. Hold the content of hesitation the same and shift real quickly just those things and in that order. Now, as you do so, it always kind of helps to also anchor each of those states. Get yourself a nice anchor. You remember all the stuff, voice anchoring? When you talk about hesitation, hesitate with your voice. That when you talk about something is done, stop your voice short. Right? So that you can use those things to elicit that state. Now, once you go through, what I want you to do is to hold the content of hesitation constant. Then what you do is change just the critical submodality. Tell them to do it quickly, and each time you do, fire the anchor. Because what you're looking for is something where when you get to doing the content change, and then I want you to have them go back to the beginning and do it faster, go back to the beginning and do it faster, until they can do it whoosh, fast. And that'll be 1, 2, 3, 4 changes in submodalities and 4 anchors. Is that clear and precise to you? Yes. Yeah, let's do it. Consider it done, huh? Okay, find yourself a new partner. Yes. Hesitation, considering it done, inevitable want and desire, and the time is now.
One of the thing that I got into with the Encounter Group people was that the concept was that you built this environment of trust with people where you could actually be more yourself and do more things than you could with your family. And that I always had a big problem with that, because it seemed to me this is where you wanted people to be able to do things, was in their life, not in your office. And especially not with a group of people, because, you know, you don't want people to have a more intimate relationship with a group of strangers than with the people in their life. If you're going to be intimate, you know, you're supposed to do it with your wife, not with your psychiatrist. And, you know, I, for a long time, used to get into it with shrinks, because shrinks would always say, well, you know, all these techniques are well and fine, but isn't the real core of therapy, the real thread and the most important thing, the relationship that the therapist builds with the client, a more trusting relationship than they could know anywhere else? And I go, no. But for a long time, a lot of the training for psychoanalysts and psychologists, that they believed that building a more trusting relationship, the massive transfers, they called it, and all that stuff, is what it was about. For me, the trick is to gather information, not build a love life. You know, I mean, I want clients when they leave that the thought of staying fixed is a lot better than the thought of coming back. I like that. You know, and they think I could call Richard on the phone or I could just do it myself. I want them to go, I'll just do it myself.
We hope you've enjoyed this time with Richard Bandler. During the last 12 years, Steve and I have devoted our professional lives to discovering and passing on ways that we can become more fully human, ways to make this a better world for all of us. We became involved in NLP after studying most of the systems and techniques people have found to change themselves and others, and we found NLP to be incomparable. The change methods are incredibly fast and reliable, and can be taught to others in a relatively short period of time. More important, it provides a model or map of where to go and what to try, even when these standard methods don't apply. There's an old story of a huge steamship boiler system that wasn't working well. The ship's owner had hired a series of expensive consultants who studied the plans and diagrams of the system for weeks, theorized about the history of the system, and gave him many reasons why it wasn't working. Finally, he asked a master boiler maker to come take a look at it. After listening to the engineer's description of the problem and asking a few questions, the boiler maker went down to the boiler room. He looked at the maze of twisted pipes, listened to the thump of the boiler and the hiss of escaping steam for a few minutes, and felt some pipes with his hands. Then he hummed softly to himself, reached into his overalls, and took out a small hammer, tapping on a bright red valve once. Immediately, the entire system began to work perfectly. The boilermaker went home. When the steamship owner received the bill for $300, he complained that the boilermaker had only been in the engine room for 15 minutes and requested an itemized bill. This is what the boilermaker sent him. For tapping with hammer, 50 cents. For knowing where to tap, $299.50. NLP has incredible and gentle power to tap people's lives in transformative and empowering ways. We hope you've realized in listening to this tape the magnitude of the possibilities being offered to take charge of our own thoughts and feelings, to be the guide of our own experience and therefore the course of our life. Listening to this tape several times and applying each process to several areas that you wish to change can begin to create a generalization of new learnings and new choices in your life. If you wish to pursue NLP more directly, NLP Comprehensive offers a wide variety of NLP books, audio tapes, and videotapes, as well as seminars and NLP certification trainings. Write to us at NLP Comprehensive, 2897 Valmont Road, Boulder, Colorado, 80301, or call us at area code 303-442-1102, or for products, 1-800-233-1-NLP. And bon voyage, good journey to you on whatever path your life might take.